job, Barbara.
Angela, alcoholic.
Angela.
Thanks, Daniel, for asking me to come up and lead this meeting. I think that we were in Las Vegas when he texted me to see if I could come up here. And, you know, like, that's one of the amazing things that I get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous today and having a sober life is being able to, like, pretty much go anywhere that I want and do anything that I want. And I can do it comfortably, and I have no problems. Welcome to anybody that's new that didn't identify. I love being at meetings where people stand up as new, and they do birthdays, and they do chips, and it wasn't my experience when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to stand up as a newcomer or take a first or second year cake as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in prison just a few days before I went in for a six-year prison sentence. So my experience was that I spent, you know, 2 years incarcerated doing the deal. And that wasn't my intention. I didn't go in with the mindset of I'm going to get sober. It just so happens that a few days before I went in, I that was my last drink. And that was nearly 9 years ago. And it's not all been amazing, you know. I grew up in Ventura and to a totally normal mom. My biological father is an alcoholic. Both of his parents died from this disease. My stepdad raised me with my mom, and they just weren't drinkers. They weren't people that had out, you know, my dad would have a beer every so often, and that was pretty much it. My mom just never drank. She was a very naturally spiritual woman, and that just meant, like, she thought of everybody else before herself, and, like, that was super, super foreign to me. From a very young age, my mom says I was an asshole, and, you know, like, a bit of a jerk, and I don't mean, like, you know, when I was, like, a teenager. I mean, like, when I was, like, 2 and 3. You know, I was just absolute trouble for her. And, but she loved me, you know. She just kept trying. And I don't identify with the people that in the rooms that say that they didn't feel a part of, and then they had alcohol and they felt more comfortable in their own skin. You know, I've always felt comfortable in my own skin. I just felt like I was born into the wrong family. I should have been, you know, of affluence. Like, I should have been a Rockefeller or, you know, somebody of, I say that in rooms today, and, like, half the room's, like, laughing, and half just, like, I don't. So, like, the Kardashians, for those of young people in here, you know, I just felt like I should have been somebody else, and I should have been better then. And I always judged everybody else. And, you know, I don't know where that came from. My mom worked really hard to give us whatever we needed. And, you know, we shopped at Kmart, and I'd be like, no, thank you. I will wait in the car. And she's like, you're 6. Get out of the car. Like, we're going to Kmart. And I'm like, no. I don't think you understand, lady. You know, and that was just, that's who I was. I just felt better than everybody else. And I didn't, I deserved much more than I had. And, I started drinking when I was 13. Because I thought I was sophisticated, I found gin in my mom's house, which was probably like in one of those china cabinets, you know, in an old glass container that they used years ago when company came over, and I found it and I made strawberry daiquiris, and I had friends with me, and, you know, we were 12, 13, and I made us all strawberry daiquiris, even with, like, whipped cream and everything. It was amazing. And, you know, I had mine and it was awesome. You know, one of the girls, like, blacked out. The other one went running home crying and, you know, never saw her again. And, you know, and for me, I was just like, this is amazing. This is awesome. And here I am. And, like, it's on now. And that's just how it was for me. And I drank like that for, you know, a very, very long time. Like, I didn't mess around with, like, a wine cooler. I used to go to the McDonald's across the street from school, and I'd have my peach schnapps, and I'd go and get orange in the big McDonald's cups, and that's what I would drink at school all day, you know, like, that's what I did. And, you know, I grew up in Ventura. I went to school there. I went to high school there. I went to both high schools. There's two high schools. I went to all three in Ventura. And, you know, I graduated only the third one because the principal of the second one told me I wouldn't. She kicked me out and told me I wouldn't graduate. And I said, I'll show you. You know, and that's because that's what I did. I did what Angela wanted to do. You know, I was a very independent thinker from a very young age. My mom says when I was really young, you know, one of the first things I said was I was changing my name. And that was just me, you know, that was how I was. And when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I start reading our literature and it talks about this spiritual malady, I realize, you know, long before my drinking started at 13, this spiritual malady was in me, you know. And I was 7 years old, and my sister and I would ride our bikes to school, and we'd go to the grocery store on the way to school, and I would steal candy, and I would sell it on the schoolyard. And, you know, I don't know how big a seven-year-old is, but, like, I'm sure if I saw one now, I'd be like, fuck, that was me doing that. You know, it's I had something that you didn't, and now we're going to be friends because of it, you know? And I was doing that stuff at a very young age, the manipulation, the stealing, the lying. Lying was very much a natural flowing thing for me. I never really knew what it was like to tell the truth, and I'm not sure where that came from. It was just from the gate, I just instantly would tell a lie because it hurt less than telling the truth was painful, you know? So I, you know, I go through high school, three of them, get kicked out of the two main ones there. I graduate eventually from an adult ed, and I'm, you know, 18 and graduating, and I'm like, I'm out of here. Like, I'm not going to stay in this small, stupid town and, like, marry the guy I went to high school with and have a kid. Like, I'm not going to be that loser. And don't worry, I become a bigger loser later. And, you know, so I'm like, I'm leaving. I'm leaving, and I moved to L.A., and I moved to the San Fernando Valley and got an amazing job, lived all around the San Fernando Valley, 11 different places over a 14-year period. And that was back when you could go to an apartment building. They had brand new apartment buildings, and it would say, like, 1 month's free rent. And I'm like, bingo, that's where I'm going, you know, because I didn't want to spend my money on rent and things like that. You know, I had a car repossessed. Like, you know, I just, like, I always had better things to pay for with my money than, you know, like, the necessities. And I didn't understand finances. Like, the whole point of adulthood escaped me. No one ever taught me that. And I, you know, there's still parts of it that I still have trouble grasping. And, you know, so, like, finances, I just thought, like, money just appeared, no? And, you know, like, my mom would always bail me out of something, or there would always be a way out. I was always being saved by somebody. So it was just my, like, that was just my natural reaction. Like, something's always going to happen. There's always money. You go to the ATM, you just put money in there, and you can take out as much as you want. You know, I always envied my friends that had credit cards for department stores. I would open credit cards and I would max them out and then I would throw it away. And, you know, that's what you did. You didn't actually pay it back. And I didn't understand anything but that. That was my mentality through life. Everything was temporary. Nothing was formalized. It was just all a big show, you know? And that's how my relationships were. I never had lasting friendships. You know, I had friends for about 6 months, and you know, then I'd get a message the next day saying, you know, you tried to run so and so over with your car, or you pulled a gun on somebody. And I'm like, I don't know, I don't own a gun. And, you know, like, it was always something that I was doing to affect somebody else's life. It was never just I was damaging my own. I was, you know, burning everything else down around me. So I just always thought that people just, they couldn't handle me, and they couldn't handle a friendship. So it's their problem, not mine. Their problem, not mine. And that's how it went. You know, I burned relationships that way with men, and friendships with women, and, you know, jobs. And it was always somebody else's fault. Never, ever my fault. And so I lived all around the San Fernando Valley, you know, drinking heavily. I had a lot of, like, Russian male friends because they could drink like I could. And, you know, no one else really could keep up or sustain the way that I could drink. And I would, you know, stay out, drink all night, and then I would just go to work the next day. And that was, you know, I'd get an hour's worth of sleep, and that's okay, because then, you know, I'd go to work all day for 8 hours, and then that night I would sleep, and then I would do it again for another day, you know, and then that would just be my period. I loved my, like, recovery day, because I could just, like, have a couple hours of good sleep, and then, you know, knowing that I was going to do it all again in a few days. And I had always had jobs in real estate, so I was administrator in real estate, and that's when real estate was really like big in LA. And so we were always throwing parties or open houses, and they always needed alcohol. So I was always around it and always needed a reason to, you know, get tipsy and drink with people and offer wine and this, and, you know, start drinking before everyone else came as I was there setting up. And so it was normal, you know, it was never weird until, you know, a couple hours into a party and I would start a fight with somebody, or, you know, I would invite somebody that probably shouldn't have been there, and then they would start a fight with somebody. So that's like how it all went for me. And stayed down there for a really long time. You know, life was awesome down there. Loved everything about LA. And I, my sister and I used to go to Santa Barbara. We had friends that played in the horse polo at the polo fields. And so we would come up on the weekends and go to polo, and then we would go out at night. You know, polo was during the day, and we would go out at night, and then, you know, we would stay out until Sunday, and we'd have what we would call Stella Sundays in the bar, where we would drink from noon. We'd drink Stella's from noon until 2 in the morning, and then I'd get in the car and drive home, you know, all the way to LA. You know, it's an hour and 15 minute drive, and like, I just did it. That was just what I did because I had to go to work the next day, you know, or it was like, or my sister and I were fighting in the middle of State Street, you know, throwing my keys at her or something. It was always wreckage around what I did. It was never like a fun, happy night out and everyone went home and, you know, like, oh, that Angela, she's awesome. Like, I can't wait to do it again next weekend. You know, it was like, fuck, what is Angela going to do tomorrow? And that's just what I did. That's the mindset that I had. I had zero regard for anybody else. And I really had no idea what it meant to be responsible. So I ended up moving to Santa Barbara and met somebody in Santa Barbara, moved up there, eventually got married, and was semi-introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, not in a way that I wanted to be, and not because I was an alcoholic, you know. I was able to curb somewhat of my drinking while I'm in a home that, you know, where another alcoholic in recovery lives, and that tends to kind of manifest itself into other ways, and that's exactly what it did. And I was able to go out, you know, Friday, Saturdays, and when I would drink as much as I could in a short amount of time. And that's just what that meant. But only drinking 2 days a week for a few hours a day doesn't stop what's going on in here. You know, nothing will stop what's happening in my head. No amount of alcohol really will stop that, you know? And it's a difficult place to sit with and live in. So, you know, I'm starting to get a little antsy, and I'm starting to feel uncomfortable. And I didn't like any of you. You know, you guys were lame and didn't understand why you were always laughing and having a good time, because how could you have a good time without alcohol? That didn't make any sense to me. And, you know, we would have these group days at the beach, and the sober people were here, and, you know, me and one of my friends would come down and they would bring beer or something. We would sit there and we would make fun of you guys. And, you know, and the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, would invite me over to these women's dinners at their house. You know, they'd always rotate a different house every week. And I would go, reluctantly go, because I had nothing in common with them. Zero. I didn't relate to them and I didn't understand them. And they still reached their hand out to me every single time, you know, and they're amazing people. And you know, I'm separated from alcohol. I don't have a solution. I don't have anything standing in the way between me and what's going on in my head. So, you know, what happens when you're removed from alcohol but without a solution? And I, you know, start really fucking up at work. And I eventually get fired. And then about 3 months later, I get arrested. My bail was $850,000. Apparently a bit of a big deal in the county jail, because all the cops, as I was booking, came in to make fun of me and laugh at me. I was a resentment waiting to happen right there. And you know, I'd spent maybe a day or two here and there when I was younger in a county jail. I think I got a DUI when I was 17, and I had to do 48 hours in Ventura County Jail, no biggie. I had no idea what I was doing, what was to come over the next few years. You know, I had zero idea, and all that I thought in my head was, no, somebody's going to get me out of this. No. Like, somebody knows they made a mistake, and eventually someone will figure that out, because I have no consequences for my actions. And I fought my court case for a year and a half. And anybody that's ever been in the criminal justice system in here knows it's generally a 30-day period that you go to court and then come back, you know, continuation. And that's how I lived my life for a year and a half, you know. And I couldn't get a job. I was in the newspaper when I was arrested, because it was such a big deal, and they made a big, you know, big thing about it. So I, you know, it was hard for me to get a job. It was hard for me. You know, this is the mind of an alcoholic. I thought that everywhere I went, when people looked at me, they knew who I was, and they were judging me. And those, you know, most people probably didn't even know who they were looking at. They didn't remember what was in the paper, you know, a month, 2 days prior to that. And that's where my mind goes. Everybody knows. They're all judging me. So I would just walk down the streets and be like, what the fuck are you looking at? To people. And they're like, we don't, you know, like, we're not looking at you. And that's how I acted. I was out on bail, and that's how I acted for a year and a half. And I would go into court and I would scream at the district attorney, you know, because that's who I was. I was rude to him. We would go in the back to my attorney and him, and I would, you know, just be like awful to this man. And he's just there doing his job. And I had zero responsibility again. I would go out on the weekends and I would jaywalk in front of cops. I would start fights. I just would be a menace. And now I'm out on bail. $850,000 bail. Like, you go back, you get arrested again, now you're really in trouble, you know? And I just had zero, like, accountability. You could sit there and tell me that I was going away for life, and I'd be like, so? I'm still going to do whatever I want to do. That's just that. That, you can't stop an alcoholic from doing the things that we want to do. It's just worthless to even try. And that's what I was like for a year and a half. And I finally got sentenced to 6 years, and they gave me 3 weeks to get my affairs in order. And, you know, during that year and a half, all I did was party and go out and enjoy life. And in that 3 weeks, that's exactly what I did. Because if I'm going to go away for 6 years, 3 years minimum, I'm going to enjoy myself over these last 3 weeks. And that's exactly what I did. I went out, I had a good time. And my last drink just happened to be at an event, a concert that we went to out on East Beach. And, you know, I decided to spend the last 2 days with my family. That was it. I gave them 2 days, you know. And looking back, you know, I regret that, but there's nothing I can do about it, you know. I chose that, and that's how I lived back then. And I went in, and, you know, my the way my mind thinks again, it's like, somebody's going to come get me out. I had no problems walking into the county jail that day, knowing I was looking at 3 years, because I literally assumed that somebody was going to come in and be like, Phillips, we're so sorry. We made a mistake. Please come with us. We have a car waiting for you. We're so sorry. And, like, you know, that's what I thought was going to happen. I thought that someone was going to open my file and go, oh, no, she shouldn't be here. You know, and that never happened. But that's what I thought. And I was in Santa Barbara County Jail for 2 weeks, and these two women that I had known from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous coming in here as a guest came in with an H&I panel. And the Santa Barbara County Jail has 4 or 5 women's pods, and they came into the one that I was housed in, and it was amazing. And I recognized these two women. It was great. And they didn't say anything like, Angela, we've seen you out there. We've seen you out partying. We've seen you at your house, you know, and these events and this and that. And we know you're an alcoholic. They didn't say anything like that. They just gave me a little bit of hope that where I was going to go was going to be okay, and everything was going to be fine. And that next morning at 4 a.m., I was transported up to the big house, the level 4 prison in called Chowchilla up in Northern California. And, you know, I look back at that much later in my story, and I know that that was a God shot. You know, those two women came into that pod that night, and I knew them, and I needed that. I needed to hear the message. And I got up to Chowchilla, you know, no joke, death row inmates, you know, walking around, and it's not a pretty place, and nothing can prepare you for something like that. And all I knew was I didn't know how I could get, you know, drugs and alcohol up there. It's readily available. But what I did know is, like, I just wanted to numb out. However that was going to happen, awesome. That's what I was going to do. And, you know, when I got up there and they bring you're on a yard for a bit, receiving yard, and no phones, no letters, no visits in the first couple weeks. And you can't even get out of your cell for much more than like an hour a day to go eat, to go shower, and that's pretty much it. And, you know, they bring some books around, and they brought two books. They said, we have the Bible and we have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, just give me the book and I'm just going to start reading. And I didn't know what I was reading. And I didn't know what I was looking at, and I didn't understand what I was looking at. But I knew that what was in that book could potentially help me. And I had a visit from my husband at the time. I had done some other things that he had just found out about, and he came to visit and basically to say that he wanted a divorce. And really all that I could conjure at that visit was, what about my car and my clothes? And, you know, that was my mindset. What about me? It doesn't matter what you're doing out there, how you're fending for yourself and doing all that. What about me? I'm in here. Don't you know that? And that was my mentality. And I walked away from that visit, and I went out on the yard, and I thought, there's something really wrong with me, and I don't know what it is. And a few days later, I wrote to one of those women, and I said that had come into the county jail, and I said, I don't know if you can help me, but I think I need help. And she wrote back, you know, and I'm about a month and a half up there, and I'm physically sober, but I'm mentally absolutely dying. Absolutely dying, spiritually sicker than ever. And I'm anxiety ridden. I don't know what's going on. I don't know where I'm at. This is a foreign place. And I, you know, I was uncomfortable and just absolutely crawling out of my skin. And one of those women said, she wrote me back and she said, here's the directions for the first three steps. And she gave me the directions, and I would write her back and I'd say, done, did this. And that woman walked me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous through the mail. And I worked all 12 steps on that level 4 prison yard. And I get to a point where I'm going to be classified to go to fire camp, and I assume that they're going to, you know, look at me and then look at my file and go, she should just be fast-tracked straight to camp and right to the fire lines. And, you know, and that's not my it's not in my time, and that's not what happened. That wasn't my experience. And I got, you know, the last thing you want to get when you're getting classified to go somewhere else is to go into general population on that, at that prison. And they sent me right over the wall into general pop onto D yard, which is the worst of all the yards. And, you know, I was done trying to decide what was right for me and what was going to happen in my future. It was just no longer in my hands. There was nothing I could do about it, quite frankly. And I went on D yard, and I was on my fourth step on D yard. And I read my, you know, it talks about in the book, when you get to your fifth step, if there's not a reason to delay, don't delay reading it to somebody else. And my sponsor could not come see me long enough to do that face to face. And so she directed me to read it to someone on the yard that I trusted and that I knew. And I found somebody that I semi-knew and had no idea if I could trust her or not, but I needed to do it. And I sat and read my fifth step to some woman on D yard, you know, and that poor lady's got to carry that stuff around with her for the rest of her life. And, you know, I needed to do that. And I eventually got off DR, and I got sent to CIW, which is the oldest women's prison in California. The Manson women are housed there. Betty Broderick, for those of you that remember her, and tried to run her husband over with a car. That's where fire camp training was, and I was there for about 6 months and did my fire camp training. That's where I was allowed to have phone calls, and I got two a week. And one was to my sponsor and one was to my husband. And the next week, one was to my sponsor and one was to my mom. And even at almost 9 years of sobriety today, I call my sponsor every day. And that's not because I want to be like an amazing example of what to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because I can't be alone with myself. If I don't stay accountable to somebody other than myself, then I'm just a few days away from thinking that those genius ideas that I always have are going to be really good ideas. You know, and instead of running those by somebody else, I start deciding that they're mine and they're good. And, you know, a day without calling her is okay. You know, 3 days I haven't called her, I haven't seen her. Now it's awkward if I run into her. So I'm not going to go to the meeting she goes to, because then it's going to be really weird if I see her and I haven't called her. So now I'm just not even going to meetings. And now I'm just getting more and more spiritually sick. And now I'm just thinking, like, this AA thing's not for me, you know? And then I'm probably not going to drink right away, but I'm going to start doing other fucked up stuff. And then it's just a matter of time before I start drinking. Because I'm not really an alcoholic. I don't need this. You know, that's where my mind goes in a very short period of time. So I have to stay accountable to somebody other than myself. And so I'm sticking to this. I'm calling her. I'm continually, you know, doing the steps and doing the work. And they have meetings there. And they've got Alcoholics Anonymous. They have Narcotics Anonymous. And they have Al-Anon. And I went to all of them, and if I didn't identify, I didn't share. I just went and I heard the message, because there was only one of those each a week, and I needed to go to meetings. Sometimes they didn't even come in from the outside to have the meeting, so, you know, I went to as much as I possibly could. And eventually, I graduate training, and I get sent to fire camp, and, you know, there's a camp in Malibu, so obviously they're going to send me there to be close to my family, and, you know, it's just not in my time, you know. It's everything is up to somebody else, and they send me down all the way down to San Diego, Fallbrook, the farthest camp they could find, you know. They could have built one in Mexico, they would have for me. And you know, I get down there, and within 24 hours of me being there, I went on my first 9-day fire, and I did that for a year. I fought wildland fires all over California for a year. And that was the most amazing opportunity that I ever had. And I don't look at my prison experience while I'm in it as an amazing thing, but I can see that now. And I love it. You know, I'm like anywhere and I hear someone just say something prison. And I'm like, somebody wants to talk about prison. They're like, nope, we don't want to hear your stories. And I'm like, but come on, you guys. You know, and I love it. I love talking about that experience. I love that I was a wildland firefighter. And I love that I got to do that. And I fought fires for, you know, over 20-something fires in that time. And I got out. I got out on an early release program. I had this amazing ankle monitor on. And, you know, I was on parole for 8 months of that time. And, you know, I get out. And, you know, anybody that's spent any short amount of time incarcerated knows it's very difficult to acclimate back into society. It's very, very hard. And, you know, after 2 years, things change. And the world carries on around you, and you know, that's not easy to digest when you get out. And I remember, like, my first day, I went into Starbucks and I didn't know how to order a coffee, and I just cried. And you know, my second day, I'm starting to think, like, you know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, and, you know, maybe it was just one of those prison things, like finding Jesus or becoming a lesbian, and, you know, and I think I'm good. And I've not called my sponsor, and I've not gone to a meeting, and I've not prayed and meditated, and I've not helped somebody else, and I'm 48 hours away, you know, from being locked up and being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous on the inside, sponsoring women at camp, to being an emotional basket case. And I went to Costco with Darren and my mom, and I'd gained a bit of weight while I was in there. You know, you carry a 40-pound pack on a fire line, and you kind of get those things up here that are awful, and I look like the Hulk a little bit, and you know, we're in Costco, and my mom's like, you gotta try this bread, it's such good bread, you gotta get this bread. And I'm like, Mom, I can't eat bread right now, I gotta lose weight. And she's like, I don't understand, you just gotta try this bread. And I just had a mental nervous breakdown in Costco. And I don't mean like, I'll be in the car. You know, I mean like I was on the floor, you know, screaming and yelling and pounding my fists on my legs. And Darren said, maybe you should go to a meeting. And the next day I went to the 6:45 a.m. Harbor Group meeting in Santa Barbara, which eventually became my home group for a few years. And, you know, it was a first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous on the outside at 2 years sober. And, you know, there was one person in there that I identified with, and it was a guy named Doug that had just paroled after doing 17 years. And, you know, I didn't understand that. And I didn't understand that we, you know, we are people that normally would not mix. And now Doug and I are best friends, you know? And I got stuck into Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. I didn't look back at that, like, maybe I'm not an alcoholic mentality. You know, I started going to meetings. I started being of service wherever I could. I, you know, went through my steps again with that sponsor. And she remained my sponsor until she moved up north about a year after that. And I got another sponsor after that. And she's still my sponsor. And I still do the same things with her that I did with the first one. We met and she went through my entire story, and we went through the steps again, and we have a monthly book study that we go through with her and her other sponsees, and you know, those are the things that I do to stay accountable to her. And you know, I had that ankle monitor on for 8 months of being out. I thought it was so unfair that I was already in prison for 2 years and now I had to have an ankle monitor. And you know, at first I hated it, and then I was like, fuck it, I'll just embrace it. And you know, we'd see people out on hikes or whatever, and you know, old people would be like, oh, what is that? It's like one of those, you know, exercise monitor things, and like, you know, tracking your steps. I'm like, somebody's tracking my steps for sure, my lady, you know, like, it's not what you think. And you know, I just got stuck into life. And, you know, I was never guaranteed a spot in my house or in my marriage while I was in prison. I burned that relationship completely to the ground. And, you know, I had to prove along the way in those 2 years that I was willing to take the action that I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous and follow it up. Not with an I'm sorry, or like, oh, I won't do it again, or like, look at what I'm doing. It was like taking the contrary action of hanging up the phone when I was in prison and because I was mad and I saw red. Instead, I would just listen and take what was coming to me. You know, I would take the feedback and I would learn from it and I would grow from it. And if I said I was going to do something, then I fucking did it. You know, and that's what I had to do. That's what I still do today in that relationship. And, you know, he came up to say he wanted a divorce, and that was what it was. And a few months, maybe a few weeks without speaking, and then, you know, I started taking the actions and doing the next right thing without saying, I'm sorry, or look at me, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was here for him while he went through that experience, and it taught me how to be in that relationship. And it's, you know, it's given us the ability to stay in the relationship together, which is, you know, it's such a big part of my life today. And I, when I first got out, I ran into that district attorney that put me away for 6 years. And I knew I had to make an amends to this man. I saw him in Starbucks. I had been out for maybe 2 weeks. And I walked right up to him in Starbucks, and I didn't know how to make an amends to somebody in person yet. I hadn't like role played it with my sponsor. All the ones that I had done while I was away were over the phone or in letter form, you know, which is not the normal practice, but that's what I had to do when I was there. And this was the first one, and I just thought, I got to do it. And I walked up to him and I said, can I speak to you outside? And he said, oh, sure, no problem. And we went outside and I said, I don't know if you know who I am. He says, I remember you, Angela. And I thought, oh, fuck. this isn't going to go well. And, you know, I made my amends to this man, and he listened to me. And when I was done, he said, thank you, and I think you're going to, you know, I think that you just got caught up in something that wasn't your fault, and you're a good person, and I think you're going to do good things. And I just wish the best for you. And that man and I today have a good relationship. When we see each other, I say, hi, Gordon, and he says, hi, Angela. You know, and that's amazing. That's an amazing result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and taking the direction of somebody that came before me, because if it was up to me, he wouldn't have been on my 8-step list. You know, and there would have been nobody on there. Oh, no, I'm good. You know, and then if it were up to me, if somebody made me put all those names on my 8-step list, I'm going to pick who I'm going to make those amends to. But that's not what it was. I didn't get the option of like the yeses and the maybes and the nevers, you know, that I hear a lot of people's sponsors walking them through the 9-step. That's a bunch of bullshit. Yeah, I didn't get any of that. You have to be willing to and will make every single one of those amends. And that's what I have been willing to do and have done if the opportunity has presented itself in almost every instance. You know, I eventually had to start looking for a job when I was out. And, you know, I knew that my life today was about being honest. And I had to sit across from these employers. And I went on 2 job interviews, and I had to tell them what I had done. I was a crime against an employer. It was in the news. It was still very relevant. And I knew that, you know, because the news was at every single one of my court cases, and I knew that when I was finally sentenced, they put that in the paper, so it was always relevant, and I knew I had to tell them what I had done, and I did, and I got both of those jobs, and I remained at one of those jobs for 5.5 years, up until they fired me last year, and they rightfully fired me because I got complacent and I wasn't doing my job, and that's okay, because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that I can walk through things like that. And it's okay. You know, my dad died 5 years ago, my stepdad that raised me. And I was able to walk through that without having to pick up a drink, without having to think that maybe this would be easier if I was just wasted. And I don't need to do that today. You know, I've walked through being sober in prison for 2 years. I've walked through losing a job and losing a dad and, you know, other, you know, traumatic events in life, and it's okay. It's life, and it's going to happen. You know, it's going to come up and it's going to happen. And the best thing that I could have done out of all of that was, you know, about with my dad dying, was to continue that living amends that I have with my mom. And, you know, I call my mom every day. We're very close. I try to see her at least once a week. She lives in Ventura still, and that relationship to me is very important. And it's important to do with her what I said that I would do. And it's no longer about what Angela wants, because it was always on Mother's Day, her birthday, what does Angela want to do? Now it's always about her, you know, and that's really important to me. And I've had this new job for over a year now, and it's an amazing job, and I needed to get back to basics, like we talk about, you know, around here in the rooms. I needed to get, and I have a better job today than I had over those 5.5 years. And that job that I had for 5.5 years was amazing. They knew who I was, and they still trusted me to have a company credit card. You know, they still trusted me to fill in for the accounting department when they fired all their controllers. Just because they knew that I could do that kind of stuff, and they just said, we know you're accountable today. And I was, and I am. You know, I'm a trustworthy member of society today, you know, and you guys don't have to hide your purses and your wallets from me when I walk in the room, because I'm not going to steal, you know, I'm just, that's who I am today. And that's what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't have a boring life. I thought that when I got sober that it was going to be boring. I was just going to have to stay at home on Friday nights and watch Law and Order reruns, you know? And we have an amazing life today. We get to go anywhere in California. We go all over the place. And, You know, I go to Vegas all the time. I've been to Vegas 8 times this year. And I don't go to, like, you know, be boring. I go and I, you know, hang out at the pool, and I go to shows. I listen to house music and electronic music, and I go watch DJs until 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's okay, because I'm comfortable doing that. And that's what I get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I, about a year ago, Darren introduced me to a guy that was a big time raver back when he was out there, and he got sober and thought his life was over. And so he started this group of other like-minded individuals that take meetings to raves and festivals. And I got stuck in with them. And, you know, it's something that I've been doing over the last year. And it's an amazing thing that I get to go to these raves where all these people are off their heads, like they're all rolling or they're wasted. And, you know, I get to be there and get to be of service and enjoy the music at the same time. And, you know, that to me is amazing. Like, that's an opportunity that I can't, I just, like, you know, I'm standing there in a crowd of 100,000 people, you know, rolling off their heads, and I'm like, this is awesome. You know, I wouldn't trade any of this for anything, and I'm not afraid to be there, and I know I'm amongst my people, and I know that I'm in the right place. And, you know, I have to remain active in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I don't, like I said about, you know, being accountable to my sponsor, this thing is just gonna leave me as quick as it came. You know, I thought that I was gonna go up to that level 4 prison and absolutely numb out for 2 years. Probably pick up another charge while I was up there, maybe stay for a bit longer. You know, I was told while I was out on bail, I had a 17-year suspended sentence hanging over my head, and I still had no regard for anybody or anything, and I still did what I wanted. And today I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, with almost 9 years of sobriety, and I have an amazing, we have an amazing life today. You know, I wouldn't change anything about it. And, you know, I can't articulate enough how I'm on a level 4 prison yard and I'm absolutely 100% free. You know, and it's a feeling that I still have today. So thanks for letting me share.
My name is Daniel, alcoholic.
Daniel.
Let's have a little round of applause for you.